It's Friday, September 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, tensions boil again following a fatal police shooting in Charlotte. Humanitarian aid, a casualty in Syria.
People may have been suppressing their intention to vote for Donald Trump.
Are voters secretly supporting a controversial presidential candidate? Also ahead, China advances in space and new music from a breakout country duo. It's all on today's International Edition. Twenty-four hours ago, the southern U.S. city of Charlotte, North Carolina, was bracing for protests, and they did happen. One person who was shot by another demonstrator during Wednesday's protests is in grave condition. The shooting apparently occurred after protesters clashed with police in riot gear, and the demonstration turned violent. Officers fired tear gas to disperse the crowds. Some people smashed store windows and set small fires in the streets. Law enforcement authorities are resisting calls for the release of video footage of Tuesday's police killing of an African-American man, but say they will comply with a request from his family to view the footage privately. Police Chief Kerr Putney stood firm on his position not to publicly release the footage.
If there is compelling information that I think helps, we'll show it. But again, I'm going to be very intentional about protecting the integrity of the investigation, and in so doing, I'm not going to release the video.
National Guard troops and the State Highway Patrol were deployed Thursday after protesters rallied for a second straight night and the governor declared a state of emergency. Charlotte officials say there are no plans to impose a curfew. The violent protests were triggered by the fatal shooting of 43-year-old Keith Lamont Scott at an apartment complex. Police Chief Kerr Putney urged citizens to consider all the facts.
There's your truth, my truth, and the truth. Some people have already made up their minds what happened. We've given multiple facts, and there'll be an update later this afternoon about more additional information we're getting. But that still doesn't change the mindset and the perspective of some who want to break the law and tear down our city.
The situation was largely calm by early Thursday, but officials are prepared for the possibility of more protests. The family of Keith Lamont Scott say that he was unarmed and insisted that he was carrying a book when he was shot. Witnesses said that he had his hands in the air. It's time for us now to turn to our social media segment with G. Abby Lee. She's right here in Studio 22 with me with all the latest. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
There was an incident in Milan, Italy, that involves a high-profile American celebrity. Why don't you tell us about that first?
Sure. So Gigi Hadid, one of the two supermodel sisters, was physically harassed in Milan, where the Milan Fashion Week is taking place. And that in and of itself is shocking, but the online buzz is actually about how the entertainment media responded to that incident. Here's an example from Showbiz Reporter. The headline reads, "Not Model Behavior. Gigi Hadid aggressively lashes out and elbows fan in the face after he tries to pick her up." So I guess you're not supposed to lash out at someone when a stranger is trying to pick you up. Mm. It also says the supermodel angrily hit out at the unknown man before running to her car. Now, to me, that's quite surprising because it's clear in the video that he literally grabbed her from the back and lifted her up before she elbowed him. And Twitter users are saying that it's quite scary that she was assaulted by a man, that's the word they used, and now she's being criticized for it. You can watch the clip from the Twitter account at Hadid News that follows both Gigi and Bella Hadid. A Huffington Post reporter based in the UK tweeted, "Alternative headline, good for her. Gigi Hadid reacts in totally appropriate way when random man tries to lift her in the street." She's on Twitter at Rachel McGrath. The man in question is confirmed as Ukrainian prankster Vitaly Siduik, who is known for harassing American celebrities.
Oh, I believe this is the guy who also got in trouble for harassing Brad Pitt and Bradley Cooper. What was his motive this time?
Well, his alleged motive is quite lofty. He said that's because Hadid has nothing to do with high fashion and, in his own words, just a well-connected cute girl from Instagram.
Wow. Well, what else is trending?
Well, 2 days after the questioning of Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf by the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs, people are still sharing a portion of the video from that event. That's because Senator Elizabeth Warren, her questioning of the stump, not the stump, but the CEO, received well over 9 million views on Facebook, and it's clear in the comments section why. Many people, especially former Wells Fargo bankers, wrote that they appreciate her standing up for the everyday Americans and asking him to resign. You can watch the clip on our Facebook page, and that's all for me today. Jim?
Okay, thanks so much, our always fashionable G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter and myself, first at our overall account for International Edition, that's at VOA underscore IE. I'm found at VOA Stevenson, and G is at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, Kabul seals key peace deal with notorious warlord. Duterte to invite UN and EU officials to investigate bloody drug crackdown in the Philippines. Promises unmet as Thailand tries to reform shrimp industry. A section of the Great Wall of China marred in the name of restoration. In India, food business challenges caste-based discrimination. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more, all at our voanews.com website and on your smartphone via our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. With five French aid workers killed near Aleppo Wednesday and 20 people killed during an airstrike on an aid convoy earlier this week, many are wondering why humanitarian workers appear to be targeted in the war-torn country. As Jeff Swikard reports, the carnage is part of a complex battle for control over what was once Syria's industrial center.
Witnesses said the strikes that hit aid workers came from the air and happened just a week after a U.S.-Russia brokered ceasefire was implemented, though it had begun to unravel. The attack that killed 20 people Monday near Aleppo forced the UN to suspend all humanitarian operations in Syria.
As an immediate security measure, other convoy movements in Syria have been suspended for the time being, pending further assessment of the security situation. However, we remain committed to stay and deliver to everybody in need.
The northern city of Aleppo is split between Syrian and opposition forces. The Syrian government's strategy is to besiege eastern Aleppo and starve out the 200,000 people that are estimated to be trapped there. It is a strategy that has worked in other parts of Syria, leading to the surrender of territory. Charles Lister is with the Middle East Institute in Washington.
In Syria. In a sense, it's a siege and destroy strategy, a starve and subjugate strategy, whereby opposition forces and civilian populations that live amongst them are forced into an eventual surrender.
The city has been under siege for months, and there's reportedly little food in the eastern part, where conditions are described as dire. Government warplanes have bombed aid convoys, which is a war crime in other parts of Syria, without any repercussions. Charles Lister says the bombings have become an integral part of the strategy of the regime of Bashar al-Assad.
There's no doubt that armed groups within the opposition are inherently reliant on civil society support. But when civil society finds itself starving for such a significant period of time, whilst also being bombarded every hour of the day, there comes a point where populations start to feel like this conflict isn't worth supporting anymore.
Lister says the steady degradation of the ceasefire proves Moscow has little sway over the Assad regime, and the chances of food aid getting through anytime soon are slim. Jeff Swikard, VOA News, Washington.
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is gaining in the latest polls against his Democratic Party rival Hillary Clinton. Trump's backers say that he has even more support than the polls suggest. That could be, as some believe, significant numbers of Trump voters are not telling pollsters that they plan to vote for him. VOA's Steve Barragona takes a look.
That's so funny.
Sandra Dull volunteers for the Trump campaign in western Pennsylvania. She says when pollsters call, Trump voters don't answer.
They're just very quiet about it. It's like
the silent majority. They're just not going to talk about it.
Dull says there are enough silent Trump voters to win the election. Many Trump supporters do not trust polls, pollsters, and all kinds of institutions. But there could be another reason why they do not identify themselves. To some, Trump voters have a bad reputation. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton put some of his supporters in what she called a basket of deplorables.
The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
Many people don't want to be put in that basket. So if someone asks who they're voting for, they may keep quiet about it, says Dartmouth College political science professor Joe Bafumi via Skype.
They'll go ahead and vote for that candidate in the privacy of a polling booth, but they won't admit to voting for that candidate to somebody who's calling them for a poll.
Something like that happened in the 1980s. Tom Bradley was the first African-American to run for governor of California. He had a big lead in the polls, but lost the election.
Many people argue it was because there were a lot of white Democrats who said that they were going to vote Democratic because they normally would vote for Democratic candidates. But when it came time to go to the polls, they didn't vote for Bradley because he was black. They voted for the white candidate instead.
Bomb the hell out of ISIS!
During the primaries, Trump did better in online polls than in telephone polls, where respondents talk to a live person, says the Pew Research Center's Courtney Kennedy via Skype.
People may have been suppressing their intention to vote for Donald Trump during the primary season of this contest. There really is not strong support to suggest that that's going on in the general election, however.
The gap between live and online polls has narrowed since the primaries, and a recent Pew survey asked people how comfortable they were discussing who they're voting for.
Really, we didn't find any difference in terms of supporters for each candidate saying that they would prefer other people not know about that support.
So experts say it's unlikely the supposedly shy Trump voters will have much impact on the election. But if the race continues to tighten, they say, even a small effect could be significant. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
There are so many factors that go into an election, including the unpredictable voter turnout. And we'll find that on Election Day on November 8th. Be sure to follow all of the election coverage online at our website at voanews.com. China took a major step forward in its space program a week ago. It sent into orbit its second space lab, Tiangong 2. Next month, Beijing plans to send two Chinese astronauts to that lab as part of a broader objective, catching up to the achievements of, and potentially overtaking, the United States and Russian space programs. My colleague Michael Lippin discussed the Chinese space program's ambitions on his latest VOA China 360 podcast with planetary scientist Pascal Lee of the California-based Mars Institute. Lee said one of the inspirations for China has been the U.S. space agency NASA's Apollo program that sent the first humans to the moon back in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
The biggest benefit of the Apollo program was not the return of lunar rocks, which is what it did in practice. The biggest benefit was the fact that it bred a whole generation of younger scientists and engineers who then went into these cutting-edge fields and are now the foundation of an economic boom in the United States. So this is actually well documented. You see a spike in people enrolling in graduate programs in science and technology, engineering and math, when there is an exciting space program like the Apollo program was at the time in the country. And so China is experiencing just that. The nation is enthralled by this effort for China to catch up and go into space. And the biggest benefit really is the fact that there's a new generation of young scientists, technologists, engineers and mathematicians rising in China.
Well, how do you think planetary scientists such as yourself in the U.S. and the West look at this effort by China to kind of excite its people about space? Do they see it more as something complementary to their own efforts to explore space, or is it more a case of, you know, China is our competitor, so we have to kind of keep an eye on what they're doing?
That's interesting. For me personally, as a scientist and as a human being, space exploration is sort of the more the merrier type of thing. The more humanity focuses on advancing the space frontier, the better off we will be ultimately as a human species. Having said that, the immediate consequence, of course, of anything like this is that it keeps existing space programs on their toes. to the point where in the United States there actually has been a congressional mandate for NASA not to collaborate technically with China in space. And this is sort of a double-edged sword. And the intent of this exclusion of China, China, for example, wanted to be part of the International Space Station, and the European Space Agency, which is a major partner on the space station, was strongly behind that, was supportive of that. The United States essentially vetoed that because Congress vetoed that. And the fear is that China might acquire technology and know-how from rubbing shoulders with the United States and the space station program. And that was viewed as being something that would not serve the interests of the United States. But the other edge of the sword is that when you exclude a partner, a potential partner like this, you also give it free rein to try to establish alliances of its own, to invest in technologies that it would have otherwise not acquired on its own, and to essentially become even potentially a stronger competitor. So I think excluding China from the United States' perspective might have a short-term benefit, but it's really being outrun at this point, from my perspective, by the drawback, which is the fact that China and other space agencies now are working together. The United States might find itself more and more alone in what it's doing in space.
Planetary scientist Pascal Lee. NASA Administrator Charles Bolden said earlier this year that he wants to cooperate more closely with China, and he urged Congress to change the law to allow NASA to do that. You can hear more on the topic by checking out Michael's VOA China 360 podcast on voanews.com. It's also on Twitter at VOA China 360 and available for free download on iTunes. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. The British country duo The Shires will be releasing their latest album, My Universe, later this month. Their first album was Brave. It drew much acclaim. And as International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the pair has gone from obscurity to stardom in less than 3 years.
You only get one life.
The Shires is vocalist Chrissy Rhodes and singer-musician Ben Earle. They became a group in 2013 when Ben, a solo artist who had toured with Katie Tunstall, posted the message, "There must be a country singer somewhere," on his Facebook page. Chrissy responded, and The Shires was born. The group was invited to 2014's Country to Country Festival and performed outside London's O2 Arena. They got their first airplay on BBC Radio for their first single, Nashville Grey Skies. Their first headlining tour came in 2015, and they released their first album, Brave, in March of last year. The album peaked at number 10 on the UK country charts. Now they have played sold-out dates across the world and landmark performances at the Glastonbury Festival and Nashville's Grand Ole Opry. Chrissy and Ben say playing the Opry was like living out a dream.
As country musicians, I think you dream of playing on that stage, and to be able to do that so early on in our career, you know, like pretty much 1 year, wasn't it? And that we were on that stage. We'd love to go back again and redo it and like just so that we can enjoy that moment even more, because it was just, we were a ball of nerves at the time.
And it's kind of like an out-of-body experience, because, you know, in our heads, that is kind of the pinnacle in a lot of
ways. It's the kind of thing you say, oh, one day we'd love to play the Grand Ole Opry, that would be our dream. And then, like Chrissy said, a year and a half later, to be on the stage, it's like your brain almost can't process that in a way.
The Shires have also been working on their sophomore album, My Universe. Chrissy Rhodes says the group began working on the new album when they had just released their debut CD, Brave.
We went away to Nashville for 3 weeks to go and write out there. We were writing pretty much every day when we were out there, and you know, we got quite a lot of songs when we were there. And then when it came to the process of deciding which ones we were going to go and record, you know, we had about, I don't know, 35 really strong contenders for the album. So that, you know, that was difficult to try and decide which ones were the ones that were going to be recorded. And then as soon as we'd recorded them, we had to decide which ones were going to make the album. And nothing's felt so difficult so far.
The Shires have released one single from the new LP, Beats to Your Rhythm, which features an infectious hook and which the duo has described as perfect for driving around in a convertible car. Chrissy Rhodes says their second single, My Universe, is a mixture of pop and country, but still holds true to its UK roots.
It's on the poppier side of country music, I think. It's still got the kind of, you know, storytelling in it as well. But we have a couple in the video that act out a kind of storyline, and we're in between kind of performing the song as well. So, yeah, it's a big step up, I think, for the next video.
The Shires are currently touring the UK in support of their new album. They announced on their Facebook page that My Universe will come out a week early on September 30th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com, like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States will lift executive order-based sanctions on Burma, which have been in place for nearly 20 years. President Barack Obama made the announcement after meeting in the Oval Office with former Burmese political prisoner and now state counselor for Burma, Aung San Suu Kyi. In welcoming the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, President Obama spoke of the remarkable journey Burma has made in recent years, a journey helped in part by the advocacy of the United States and others in the international community, but most of all because of the courage and strength and resilience of the Burmese people. Milestones on that journey have been a transition from a military dictatorship to elections that brought Aung San Suu Kyi herself into the government, as well as a representative legislature that, despite constraints, is, President Obama said, giving voice to the hopes and dreams of a new generation of Burmese people. Lifting the sanctions, he added, is the right thing to do in order to ensure that the people of Burma see rewards from a new way of doing business and a new government. The United States is also restoring Burma's trade benefits under the Generalized System of Preferences, which provides commercial and trading advantages for poor and developing countries as they enter into the global economy. Burma's benefits were removed in 1989 after the military junta cracked down on pro-democracy protesters. President Obama said that reinstating trade benefits for Burma, along with lifting economic and financial sanctions, will give U.S. businesses and nonprofit institutions greater incentives to invest and participate in what the U.S. hopes will be an increasingly democratic and prosperous partner for us in the region. Burma still faces significant challenges, including a long-standing civil conflict and discrimination against the ethnic Rohingya minority in Rakhine State. The new government has committed to tackling Burma's long-standing issues inherited from the previous government. President Obama praised Aung San Suu Kyi for convening a peace conference to address armed conflict in the country and reaching out to ethnic minorities, including the Rohingya, who have faced discrimination. "We are very hopeful about the future," said President Obama. "More work remains to be done, but Burma is on the right track."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.